some of those things are going to be absolutely difficult to transfer. Some of them will die. But there are some that'll last forever. And it's happening in the Maori world, as Rose is saying. And fortunately for me and others like me, like those people out there, we're in an institution which can shift it from mainstream knowledge base into a cultural or bicultural or Maori base, and we enjoy the opportunity here to do that. Those students that are up there, we teach them the knowledge base of the things you're talking about. Aroha. What does aroha? Does it mean the American form of love? Or does it mean other things? And we're able to analyze it and pull it down. So aroha is a touch. Hey. Mm-hmm. Although the law says it's illegal now, but that's an expression of aroha, you know. Tēnā koe, and the touching. And you continue with that aroha to the whenua and personalize it by aroha to Papa Tuanuku. Aroha ki ngā tamarikia tāne mahuta, and you shift out into the forest and all that grows in there, and the creatures in it. And it all comes off aroha. Aroha ki te flax bush. Because here is the whakapapa of that flax bush.
Mm-hmm.
Here is the role that harakeke plays in our lives. Previously it played a very, very vital role. It provided clothing. It doesn't do that anymore. But it still provides beauty in the environment, shelter for all sorts of creatures, a plaything for our children today. We can still teach them how to weave little square mats and put them on the wall and put their picture in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes a photo frame. We can still teach them how to make little play boats out of the korari.
Mm.
And float them down the creek. So it still plays a vital role, slightly changed, but aroha ki te harakeke.
Mm-hmm.
Aroha ki ngā manu. Why? Because they provide that enrichment to our environment. Sit, listen. What's that bird singing? Many of our students have never heard a bird sing.
Oh.
But we have that opportunity here to push the parameters out. So it does still exist. So there are examples all over the place, Makere, of the deeper meaning. Still, there are people still attempting to reach the deeper meaning, the cultural significance, through te reo. Aroha is a huge concept, and it applies in all sorts of ways in the culture. And if we can get that message across, then we're ensuring that our generations who are following us will have some idea of the deeper meaning. Because Rose is quite right. We say aroha and manaaki and karakia and pōhiri are part of our culture, but it stays at that shallow level.
Aye.
Eh? In the schools.
Aye.
I doubt whether it happens in homes.
Mm-hmm.
Because te reo Māori, sadly, is only most prevalent in learning places.
Mm-hmm.
Like this, like the schools, like the universities, like the marae. And at the grassroots level, I am a bit worried about that. It happens with my own mōpuna. Mm-hmm. I try with them, mm-hmm. but then they're exposed to English parents. And so it's me competing against their own parents.
Oh.
I come in for 1 hour. The parents have them for 23 in a day. So those things are happening. But doesn't mean to say it's not happening. It is happening. And maybe we can win some of the battles. But Rose is quite right. The deeper meanings. So those are all attempts at recovering. This is only one of them, and I know it best because I was one of the facilitators. Waiata wānanga going on all over the place, on marae, marae based. Whakapapa wānanga. Ōtaki raukawa wānanga, Aotearoa wānanga and awa nui ārangi are providing a combined front in this push. Because we can do it, because we got some control over the content of the curriculum. So I can be free to take my class in the bush and talk and teach and draw and touch and taste there rather than in the classroom. This is a kauri tree, can draw the leaf, and they draw it from a picture. But because I'm at a wānanga and others like me are at a wānanga, we can explore and explode boundaries too. We can break boundaries. And those students are sitting up there, I hope, are telling Colleen, these are the things we are being taken through by our tutors.
In the Bachelor of Education program.
In the Bachelor of Education.
Isn't that something?
So I say to them, for example, I've got the caretaker's truck, it's out up here, put all our desks, put all our chairs on the back, tie it down, and I'll drive it over there, you follow me on your cars. That's the beginning of a lesson. So we get way out into that bush area over there and unload, 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 sit around. And we're sitting under a tree and then whoosh. And he said, oh, look, 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 that bird has caught that other bird. Came out of the blue, bang. And we were sitting around under in the bush. There's a little open special patch over there and other birds were picking the seeds. Whoosh. So I was able to switch my lesson and talk about the kāre area and talk about Te Ateirangi kāhu. Because this was a kāhu that came out of the blue, captured one of the smaller birds and sat there holding it in his claws. And there we were under that tree there watching it. Will I see that if I was sitting in a classroom over here? Those sorts of things happen. I said, look at that ridge. How many Māori trees can you see growing there? They saw none. There's a pōtuka right in front of them. There's a manuka right in front of them. There's a tīkoka right in front of them. There's a hinahina right in front of them. So you can do these kinds of things because I'm at a wāna. Doubt if I was able to do that if I was a secondary school teacher at Whakatāne High School. Because there's a program. That I had to sit down, the bell rings, they move on, bell rings, they move on. I can't borrow the caretaker's truck. If I was, say, Whakatāne High School, could I?
Kāre.
So it's easier to say, oh, Jeff, can I have your truck for? What for? I want to take my class, but I want the furniture out there. He says, yeah, bring it back this afternoon. Hey, we can do that at places like
this.
Beautiful. And then we see a kāre area hawk capture its prey right in front of us. So I switch the lesson around. Leave the trees for a while.
Tātārangi kāhu, iaha tēnā.
He kāhu, kāhu of the door.
Tātārangi kāhu?
What?
Is that part of its name?
Of what?
The kāhu?
Kāhu is the bird.
Aye.
Tātārangi is of the dawn.
Oh, aye.
The hovering bird of the dawn time.
Oh.
So I was able to bring those things in because there's a sparrowhawk sitting there clutching a sparrow in his claws. And straight away we can use that as a teaching time. So the wānangas can do these kinds of things. And Raukawa Aotearoa and Awa Nui Ārangi maybe as a combined front can recover, be part of this recovery program. People like Rose, who holds wānangas in Waikaremoana, and others like her, is part of the recovery process. The question is, of course, will we succeed? This project that me and my family and my hapū and my iwi developed we're succeeding in recovering the ryo, the vocabulary. Two examples I gave to you. Hauhake, unknown word to this group of people, until they all come home to Hauhake the Kumara.
Hmm.
So it's not just lifting the crop.
Hmm.
Eh? It's lifting it, it's drying it, it's cooking some, it's having some for tea, it's catching a fish that goes with the kumara at that time of the year. So some are detailed off to go and catch the kehe, because they are fat at this time, and that's the fish that's used with the new kumara. So hauhake becomes all those things, plus the waiata that goes on at night after a couple of bourbons. Hey. So you waiata. And then you get up early in the morning because you've got some more hauhake to do. So there are disciplines, there are technologies, there are methodologies. What do they call that word? Pedagogy.
Pedagogy. Pedagogy.
Of that work.
Uh-huh.
And then they've got to get on their cars and get back to Auckland before Monday morning. So you have your poroporoake. Maybe on the kumara patch.
Mm.
Uncle, we gotta go. Haramai, karakia, before you go.
Mm.
And all that pedagogy, which a hauhake can now let loose on them. Hauhake, before that, was just the word. You look it up in the dictionary to find that. Oh, harvest. That's what hauhake means. But see, under the terms of this project, for example, the deeper meanings come through, if that is your question.
Aye, absolutely.
And then how to dry them, the technologies. Mm. And the rua is already there, all prepared to take the new crop. And a couple of ancient karakia that go with it. And a Māori for the Mara. So I say to them, tēnei kōhatu. That side, nor from the top of our mountain. And here it is, it's in a special place at our edge of our Mara. In fact, it's beside the Rua.
Oh.
I said, he Māori tēnā. My brother talks about it during the lunch breaks. Or my sisters, who also older than me. Or my uncle. How do my uncle tell the whānau about lunchtime. So during the weekend we try and get all these and put a hangi down to cook some kao to be ready on Sunday afternoon for them. Haramai pichichi, haramai.
You haven't got a Māori dictionary up.
Aye, honey, honey.
I'm just doing that. I'm going to use the Monty.
Thank you.
Got an English
one? Aye. Aye. Aye, honey.
Sure. Thank you.
You want a thesaurus? Am I making any sense?
Perfect. Beautiful.
Whether we succeed or not. And the treaty hui we had the other day may link us up with tangata taketake, originals, indigenous of the world. My best hope is that that will happen and we become excited because we're part of a movement across the world. We're part of a tidal waves, so to speak. And we become excited because we have a contribution. So they're asking me to be one of their keynote harami.
Mm, mm-hmm.
So they got a surprise coming. If I see that the marae is not the place to do it, then I'm going to take them to the riverside, maybe, and talk about stones, maybe, because you see those stones up there? You know, you see the story they're telling? When I get a stone like this, what's that stone telling? And when I get a stone like that, what's that stone telling? Look at the story these two stones are telling. Hey, the geological story.
Yes.
in Maori terms, it's exciting.
Yes, absolutely.
So that one, if they want me to talk about environmental science, it may not happen on the Malay. Because I know they're living next to a river.
Kia ora.
So there's a basis.
Matua, when I was even younger than I am now, and I would ask my whānau different things, they would say to me, Sissy, go and talk to the stones. And at first I would think, yeah, why don't they just tell me? Eventually I learned to do that.
You can sit by the river and just with those 200 or 300 stones around at your feet, pick up different ones. And they will talk to you.
Aye.
Mehemea kai te tika tēnei.
Aye.
Said, how did you assume that shape? What happened to you last year, 100 years ago, 10,000 years ago?
Mm.
Please tell me.
Mm.
Aye. So they tell me how they belong to a strata.
Mm.
And how rua moko, mood, and a peace got carried away.
Mm.
Okay, you can assume that kind of role. Why are you shaped like that? Kōrero mai. So this group of teachers, if they're wanting to have a look at Mātauranga Māori knowledge base and see what they can extract out of there to build their lessons on, then it may not happen on their marae, as they're telling me. It's on the marae at Tōrere, and we want to bring these people in. And I know the Tōrere River is just over there.
Right.
So, that kind of mentality, that kind of attitude, and goodness me, our oral literature is full of supporting evidence. Well, rua moko, I'm just mentioning rua moko, the unborn child yet. When he moves in his mother's womb, tectonic plates move, tsunamis occur. Hey, you can shift it to Aceh in Indonesia. Places like that. Whakaari, our own active volcano on our horizon.
Mm-hmm.
What is it saying? Chichiroa to hell. It's going that way, it's going straight up, straight as. It's going like this and it's going like that.
Ah.
It's just billowing out of the crater. Some days there's nothing happening, just the island. What is it saying? So you can introduce, I suppose, into the education of the people, the messages of the world around them. And some of them are very, very applicable to today.
Mm.
Tidal waves, rua moko. There's a rua moko haka there to support your teaching.
Mm.
Weha. And I find it interesting. I find it exciting. And those students up there are not 15, 16, 17 year olds. They're 30, 40 year olds. So they've been out there, had a look around, and then come back with a desire. And they're easy to teach. And I love teaching them. Well, I love teaching my little 2 and 3 year old mokopunas too. So is that saying anything for you? Some of the things that's happening in my world.
Absolutely.
I think that the indigenous rejuvenation and reassertion is in fact a global movement. It's not, certainly not unique to Māori. And so by getting involved in that, there is already a move to be part of a global movement. And global citizenship has got more than one meaning in this sense, and that is it enables Māori to be part of the indigenous world movement.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been quite important, I think, and not only important in terms of a sense of solidarity, but economically it's going to be important too. You can imagine mm-hmm. business ventures and economic, where you'll get preferred providers who might happen to be indigenous, and whether it's in fishing or some other arrangement. So I think that Māori, if there hadn't been this rejuvenation and revitalisation, the sense of being indigenous would not have escalated to the degree that it's at now.
Mm-hmm.
So that we can participate as citizens in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
But then the other point is, and that certainly for Māori, and we've had this slogan since 2001, which is now part of the Education Department's broad direction for Māori education, is that it should be possible for Māori to live as Māori and be citizens of the world. And so we've got that joint, the dual pathway, and the sense now in education, I don't think they're doing a particularly great job in doing it, but is saying that one should not be at the expense of the other, need not be at the expense of the other.
Mm-hmm.
Living as Māori, mm-hmm. and being a citizen of the world are joint requirements in modern times,
mm-hmm.
and the education policy needs to be able to see that that is possible, that you don't have to sacrifice one for the other.
Mm.
And then, of course, Māori mobility has just sort of escalated this.
First language English speaker, and her husband is the bilingual, you know, speaker, and she talked about their needing to think about having a what she described as a CAS to go with a LAS. So you have the language acquisition system, whatever you want to call that.
Right.
But you've also got a cultural acquisition system.
Okay.
And in the most ideal situations, they are so intertwined that they don't come apart. But when you've been through sort of experiences of colonisation that have been about language removal, they have come apart.
Yes.
So that's our reality. And so it's sort of like it's no blame, no shame,
sure.
No, you know.
Sure.
And so it's saying, and for that, I guess that is saying that we have to believe that you can still be culturally who you are, even if you're in a situation where you're redeveloping language, because otherwise we cease to exist. You know, if we've been through process of colonisation, which has been about de-languaging. So, I think it's sort of, I think, you know, when we may listen to people and think, oh, the way they're saying things might be the way that they might have been said if you're a first language or a native language speaker. But that's not to say the way you're thinking it isn't culturally, what's the word for it? Viable, there's a word I'm trying to think of, but I can't think of it.
A couple of things have happened. Firstly, the psyche has been damaged with the loss of the World Cup. The character of the relationship between Māori and Pākehā in this country was founded on the rugby.
Mm-hmm.
Not on education.
Mm-hmm.
Founded on rugby. Why was it founded on rugby? Because on the rugby field, the Pākehā recognised that there were Māoris out there that were as good as them, if not better. And it's changed. There are now more Pacific Islanders in the All Black team than Pākehās, and there are more Pacific Islanders than Māori. And twice now we've lost the World Cup. Well, we challenged and we lost it. We've lost actually three times. Then the whole Labour government, Norman Kirk, came in. That sort of reinforced and steadied things a lot. Got things moving, lots of Māori got into education. Opportunity. All through the follicle for Labour. Said to me, "You know any Māori?" I said, "Yeah." "Like who?" I said, "My cousin." I said, "He's just slumming away down the East Coast." So we rejuvenated Bill Tafai's career. I got him into hood. Through Philemos. Because he asked me, who can we get into this hospital?
Oh my goodness.
Politically, Norman Kirk's government was the one that gave the Maori the opportunity through education. Shifted the focus from rugby to education. And simultaneously you had Fina Cooper's march. Okay. And there were 12 of us from around the Bay of Plenty here who were in the first course, crash course of teachers, whose only qualification was to speak Māori. You asked what the impact of languages. Phil Amos was a brilliant politician in terms of having a vision of how to get Māori moving forward. I said, the shift didn't happen just naturally. There was a political decision made to get Māoris into secondary schools. And our qualification, you could speak Māori. And of the whole group, I was the only one that really understood English.
Amazing. What year was this, Manu?
74.
Yeah.
But you used to get tuned to
tape the all teachers. The courses at the teachers' college. And at night, I listened to these lectures and I translated into Māori what they were saying. So the whole course could understand what the hell was going on.
Oh my
God. Mad things happen. Language skill acquisition. Alright? So they gave us a French professor.
Well, that makes lots of sense.
Yeah.
Oh.
At university, not at teachers' college, at university. None of us had been to university. Okay? So then we're plonked in this first lecture. He goes flat out off and goes up. Yes, want you to explain that. That's for the tutorial. I'll do that in the tutorial. About the fourth time, our people were getting angrier. I stood up and I said in Māori, "Ko rahi tēne, ko puto tātou ki wā. We're gone, out of here." We left the bloody French professor there. We took off, went round to the principal of the teachers' college. Yes, Māori, we're going home. Why? Until you find somebody who can teach us. So we came home, and everybody thought, Glenda said, oh, you've got to get the bloody sack, and you do it, and I haven't even started, and you're already giving orders. That's you all over and everything else. You see, but I thought,
now some things don't change, eh?
We were shortchanged.
Yes.
We were thrown into a system that didn't want us, didn't want to change to accommodate us. And here we were pioneers in bringing the language into the secondary school. Okay. And if we jump to what happens at Toastmasters competitions, what they're about is the skill and the ability of a person to retain a certain body of knowledge and utilize it in a manner which is both humorous and logical. And if you try to attack on the moral sense, you lose. Try to attack on the ethical sense, you lose. Because the competition is about the heart of the language. Yeah. The mita of the language.
Kia ora.
That's what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
And Māori are bloody brilliant at it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're brilliant because we get pulled up at every occasion we speak. When I was learning to speak on the marae, these old fellas used to sit me down on the pipe, eh? Then they would see somebody and say, this is what you say to that fella. And I said, yeah, that's what, yeah, you're right, yeah. So I believe these old buggers. I'd get up and say it, and I'd get a bloody tongue lashing from the other side.
And I'd come home to... And your own kui and the whare mate, too.
Yes, my own kui and the whare mate. Giving me hell, and these other old bloody buggers laughing like anything.
Yeah, I can just see it.
So we're trained in a very vibrant situation. It's not an individual sitting. No way. There is a communal approach to language. The same way that we approach the economy. I taught a course that I call communal capitalism at School of Business Management Studies at Wellcome. And the basis of that was quite simple. Capitalists about getting value for the dollar and making a profit. Yeah. The way they do it is either through hard work, skill, opportunity, or inheritance. The way Māori do it is that there may or may not be an opportunity. There is hard work. There is some skill. There's no inheritance. Yeah. So what do? They work to make a profit, but in a communal manner. When I told you that story about Tipunarangi Tukehu in Rhode Island, Kendrick had found out how he worked. He'd say to one of his people, "Kia rua nā rākau kia koe. You're cut. Two kauri. One for you and one for the whānga. Kia rua nā pōka kia koe. One for you, one for the whānga. Kia rua nā tana harakeke mō. One for you, one for the whānga." Alright. Then I put them together and we had an enterprise.
Well, you know, William Geddes said to me a couple of years ago, he made the comment that the communities are disintegrating, and even on the Western Isles of Lewis, and then he said, but new communities are forming, and some of them are diasporic communities and people that are, you know, whose parents maybe left, like my dad or whatever. And he said, and some of them are green-minded communities, and maybe they're the ones that will bring back the garlic. And yet, yes and no, and I hear that there's an ambivalence around that, and there's a part that wants to say no, no, because, and I heard that in Galgail from young Sean, Seamus. When I mentioned that, he said, oh, but, you know, but they'll never have it right and they'll never be the same. And that's true.
That's true because it's an organic thing. Culture is all organic. And if you try and, you know, artificially bring it back, you're going to get artificiality.
Yes.
You know?
Somebody else's hybrid version of something that they think.
Yeah. Yeah, because the difference is that you're, if you learn Gaelic from the knee, you're learning about traditions and so on, you learn, you're not learning, you're just, it's like, you're just soaking it in as you grow up. Whereas if you learn a language, you don't learn it in that way, you learn it in some other way. You know, you don't, so it's a different procedure, isn't it? Learning in a community of speakers that's doing it just as a necessity, as it were. You know, their life is a necessity. They want to learn a living. Don't think about the language at all.
That's right.
You know, it's just a part of life.
So we lose a great deal in that, I think, in that, you know, yes, we can become semi-fluent learning it at university or college or e-learning or whatever, but I hear this at home, and this is part of what gave rise to, you know, part of my question there was, I'll listen to these, especially some of the young male speakers at home, and they're, you know, they're fluent as such, and they'll strut their stuff, they'll stand and they'll speak, and they know their tikanga or their customs or whatever, and they're proud young Maori males. And often when I sit and listen, I know that they don't really know the meaning of what they're saying in a deeper sense, or they would not be saying and doing the way they're saying and doing. And they would be mirroring different ways of things. And I see it and I hear it when I listen. And I think, I mean, they don't know that they don't know. But with that, though, is not knowing a particular kinds of values. And those values are missing in in their articulations and their all of their things.
I'm not the son of a crofter, for a start.
You know. Right.
My father was, he came from a crofting family, my father. But he was a missionary in the church, in the Free Church of Scotland. In fact, he was a missionary in Staffan here. And he met my mother when he was in Staffan. And married, you know, and that's how, in fact, she was from this croft here, you know.
How lovely.
And that, so, he would be staying in that place for a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, and then the church would move on to some other place. So I started life in Staffan. I was in Uig, just across the way, until I was 4 or 5. And then we moved to Borb in Lewis, and that's when I went to school. A Gaelic-speaking village or district in Lewis, Borb. I went to school there. I couldn't speak any English. It was just yes and no. I couldn't speak English. It was just yes and no. But when he went to the school, it was teaching was done through the medium of English, so he soon learned English. So I became bilingual.
Right.
And then from Borne, went to Watternish, and I went to primary school in Watternish for a couple of years until my father moved back to Staffan when I was 8 years old. And I was here for 4 years then. And went to the primary school over here. But none of these schools I went to taught to the medium of Gaelic, although the pupils mostly all had Gaelic. We spoke Gaelic to each other, you know.
Was that frowned on?
Not in my day, but you hear stories about people generation before me being, maybe some of my generation as well, being reprimanded or... They used to put a stick, in, not in my generation, before that, they used to put a stick around a person. So the person, you passed it on if you spoke Gaelic. The person, the last person of the day to speak Gaelic had a stick around their neck. That was done in probably the beginning of the 20th century or end of the 19th, yeah. So that's the kind of life I had. Then from Staffan we moved to Glenelg on the mainland, which is the only place I was in where Gaelic wasn't the dominant language. My father had to learn to preach in English then, because they couldn't not enough people understood Gaelic there. So it was a bit awkward for him, but he managed. And there, from there, we left to go to Achmore in Lewis again, and I went to Lewis Castle College in Stornoway, and I was there for about 16, and then went off to sea.
Did they teach or speak in Gaelic at the school in Stornoway at the time?
Teachers.
Did they teach Gaelic, or did they teach in Gaelic?
Not in the college.
Right.
It was a technical college.
Okay.
I did navigation.
Right.
And seamanship. But in Nicholson Institute, and I was there for a term. It was a big school in Stornoway. They of course they had Gaelic there. You know, they taught Gaelic there.
Right.
In Gaelic classes, not through the medium of Gaelic though, as a subject.
Ah, okay.
Which is a strange sort of thing which happens in secondary schools.
Yes.
You taught Gaelic. To the medium of English, you know.
I remember learning French like that.
I'm not sure I suppose the natives, if there was a native speakers class, they would probably, you know, speak in Gaelic, I would think. But even in university, when I went to Edinburgh University in the Celtic department, it was English that was spoken. That was in the 1970s. They were speaking, doing the Gaelic course through the medium of English, which was a bit strange.
It were a bit strange indeed.
Yeah.
So in the 70s, when you did your teacher training, that was as a Gaelic medium teacher?
It was as a Gaelic teacher, and I was teaching in secondary schools.
Right.
As I said before, in the secondary schools, Gaelic is taught to the medium of English, funny enough. To learners, I'm talking
about.
Yes, sure. The learners come into school first year, second year.
Right.
And they don't have any Gaelic, so you teach them from books and so on, and that's the way it's taught.
No wonder it doesn't work.
Exactly. It's like they teach French, like teaching a foreign language. That's the way. And the materials from the SQA are aimed at that, you know, the Scottish Qualifications Authority. In the 80s, things changed, you know. From about 1985 onwards, there's a Gaelic medium school set up in Renes, in primary school. And so that was, these were children being taught to the medium of Gaelic. And now things have moved on to the extent that in places like Portree, you've got four or five subjects in the secondary school being taught to the medium of Gaelic.
Uh-huh.
So the children are coming through from the primary school into the secondary. Mm-hmm. It's not happening enough. There's a lot of difficulties, particularly getting teachers.
Right.
Teachers who can teach Gaelic, that's a big difficulty.
Subject teachers teaching Gaelic is huge. It's the same with Māori at home. And what we found is that Māori, well, at one stage they had a policy of taking a fluent Māori speaker off wherever, put them through a crash course in teaching, turn them out the other side as the Māori teacher who taught Māori, taught in Māori, taught maths, geography, whatever theoretically in Māori, on the basis of a one-year crash course in teaching, and complete disaster.
Yeah,
and then, of course, the government would say, well, we've thrown all this money, we've done all of this, and it's not working, so...
I can imagine, yeah.
Sounds very similar.
There are efforts being made to recruit teachers, you know, some efforts are being made, right enough. And some people who have learned Gaelic are coming into teaching. Quite a lot of people, I would think, are coming into teaching. But maybe they've been learning Gaelic for years and years, you know, and then come into teaching. So, that is a priority. Has been for a while with Border Gaelic and so on to try and. In fact, I think Sol Morosic has a course for teachers now this year, starting this year.
Right.
Where they can their teacher training, Gaelic medium teaching it. And Aberdeen as well, Aberdeen University, they train teachers, and and of course there's Strathclyde University as well. So there are efforts being made.